Dad's Move podcast. I'm your host, Joe Saladino. Last month, I was lucky enough to attend the National Federation of Families Conference in Chicago, Illinois, with my boss, Nelson, supervisor, Sarah, and co-peer, Will. While we were there, we presented, we attended, we learned a lot, but I was also able to sit down and have a couple of interviews, specifically with Gail Cormier, who is a project director for National Federation of Families, and Lachelle Freeman, who's a project manager. These are those interviews. Enjoy.
Name and title.
Okay.
We'll start there.
Well, I'm Gail Cormier. I am the project director of NASTAC, the National Family Support Technical Assistance Center, and that's part of the National Federation of Families.
And so, essentially, what do you do?
Oh, what we don't do.
Okay, yeah, we can do that too. Yeah.
We're a little organization, so we do a lot. But my primary focus is to oversee the first families, SAMHSA family-centered of excellence for the Federation. So I oversee the SAMHSA grant. It's a 5-year grant, and it is to provide technical assistance for...
Oh, hello. Never a dull moment.
It's to provide technical assistance for the workforce, the family support workforce, families in general, family members, and the family-run organizations.
Okay. Very cool. So 5-year grant, what year are we in?
We are just beginning our 4th year. And I should mention that the SAMHSA grant for the Center of Excellence really is a primary focus for a couple of really important things. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's a lifespan. We are talking about where parents and family members who take care of our loved ones, not just what between the ages of 0 and 26, but throughout the lifespan. So it's a lifespan grant, and it focuses on both mental health and substance use. And I think if you heard today when we were listening to the speaker, mental health and substance use really goes hand in hand.
That was amazing how he put that together. That,
oh, absolutely.
For those listening that aren't at the conference and haven't seen, we had a speaker talking about substance abuse issues and going along with that, okay, and he's got a good handle, thinking he has a good handle, but hasn't addressed his mental health issues, and then was basically looking down the barrel of a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's that's amazing that to put the focus on that both need to be addressed.
Absolutely, and oftentimes in my role, I'm old. I've been in this field for a very, very long time, but I've always seen very siloed. You either have mental health or substance use issues.
Right.
Never shall the two meet, which sounds outrageous to even the layperson that, you know, if you have, why are you using?
Right.
Well, probably you're self-medicating. And why are you self-medicating? Something doesn't feel good.
Right.
So... And it could be physical or mental health.
Wow. So let's go back. What got you into this field? What got you into helping people and these types of things?
It's a really funny story. What got me into this field? Well, I can go way back when I was 12 and 13 and watched the Bob Newhart show.
Perfect.
And he was a psychologist. And I said, I'm going to be a psychologist like Bob Newhart.
Did you go out to Navy Pier?
I've been there.
Gotten the picture with Bob Newhart?
No, I know I haven't, but that would be a great thing. I forgot that he was out here.
Oh, yeah. I've got the picture. I got the selfie.
I wanted to be Bob Newhart. So, you know, got... You know, I didn't even recognize the mental health issues in my own family, but I can get to that in a minute. So I went off to college to become Bob Newhart. I learned really quickly that 55-minute hour was not what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, graduated with my bachelor's and kind of worked in the juvenile justice field and, you know, worked my way up, got, you know, really started realizing that I really wanted to be hands-on, maybe rehabilitation. I'm work-focused, so I really felt that I saw people with mental health issues get better just by getting holding jobs and being really contributing members in society. And I took a job in New Hampshire, and it was under a grant called Renew. And Renew was all about work and youth. So I was the guru of youth. I was a lot younger than I am now. But we learned that if we got kids really invested in what they were excited about, they would soar. And that's what Renew from New Hampshire was all about. And I was great to be a co-founder of that. Well, while I was at Renew, while I was, you know, really the Renew coordinator at that point in time, but I did move myself up to the director, I went to this conference. And it was in 1998. And people were all very friendly. It wasn't a stuffy conference. They had a band at night and a dance with youth and children, and everybody was really excited, and they spoke my language.
Yeah.
And the first executive director from the National Federation of Family spoke, and I went, oh, wow, I want to be her. And that started my journey. Now, I didn't go right from Renew to the Federation. I had several different paths. But first I realized that I had three daughters, all who had mental health diagnoses. Now, I'm very fortunate. They're all adults. They're all very successful. They're college graduates. They're healthy. But when the phone rings, my heart skips a beat, because you're a mother as for a young person, whether they're, and for me, my older kids are 38, 36, and 26, but still they're young people to me.
Right.
They're my children. You never stop being the mother. And mental health and substance use issues do not go away when you turn that magic age of 18. So most of the time, my children are fabulous. But every once in a while, the phone will ring, my heart skips a beat, and my kid's in trouble. So that's how I sort of got to this job. I went from Renew, and when that grant ended in New Hampshire, we actually were able to incorporate and form a nonprofit that continued Renew on. I became the executive director. So I had this executive director nonprofit experience. One day I was at a system of care state meeting in New Hampshire, and it was negative 17 degrees for the third day in a row. No. My middle daughter was going to the University of Tennessee. And we're still in New Hampshire. And it was just cold. It was miserable. The System of Care conference was fabulous. But as we were getting out of the White Mountains to drive, almost all of us System of Care staff almost got killed in a car accident. We all skidded off the mountain road, and we all kind of had to get back together. And I got home, and I was tired. And we had been going to Tennessee, University of Tennessee football games, where in November, which it was beautiful and warm, and I was cold. And my husband said to me, hey, I just went to my company's conference, and there was a guy there from North Carolina in my company that has an outlet in North Carolina. And he said, my job that's here in Massachusetts, it's open in North Carolina. And he laughed. He goes, we always wanted to be warm. Do you want me to look? And he totally expected me to say, what? Right. No, I'm not leaving New England. Listen to this accent. I'm not leaving New England.
You got like a sore thumb.
Exactly. So, and instead, I was slumped on the couch. I was freezing from that negative 17, 18 degree weather. And I went, go explore it, please. He did. We came to North Carolina. Long story short, my professional experience of being a nonprofit executive director, coupled with my lived experience of having three children who all have diagnoses. And I have a father who has schizophrenia and a mother who has depression and a sister who was just recently, well, 10 years ago, diagnosed with bipolar. I am the epitome of a family member. And I myself have a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. So roll that all up, and I became the state family-run executive director for the state of North Carolina. I was the ED for North Carolina Families United. That's where I met Nelson and all my other colleagues that are all state family-run org executive directors. And I got a lot of my education from them, too. Mm-hmm. You know, we share, we got together, we were able to, you know, really be peers to each other as executive directors, because no one you know is an executive director of a nonprofit, which is a family run, except your peers. And so we could share battle wounds and mm-hmm. battle stories, but we also learn from each other. And where did we learn? At the National Federation of Families Annual Conference, which, by the way, ever since I went the first time, I think I've missed four of them.
Wow.
So we learned and we grew and we shared. And then one day, North Carolina Families United was doing very well. And it was 2020. Is that year? That's a very fateful year. Mm-hmm. And it was January. And I had just taken a couple of weeks off and we were going to beat the pandemic, and I was going on a cruise. Get that? Cruise, COVID, mm-hmm. pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But I was literally climbing up the gangway. Is that what that's called?
Yeah, or
gangplank. Gangplank.
Or is the plank the one that you
push people
off
jumping,
of?
Yeah, one of the... I'm not jumping off of it. But I was just going up there to enter, and my phone rang. And, you know, you're not supposed to have your phone because you're checking in and all that. Right. But I answered the phone, and it was Dr. Linda Goggin. And she said, "Gail, SAMHSA just put out a grant for a technical assistance center. And I want to know if I could write you in to be the director."
Wow.
And I went, "Okay, what the heck? I'm off to a new adventure." She goes, "Well, let's talk about it." I said, "Linda, I'm off on a week's cruise. I will call you. I have to hang up right now, but yes, yes, I'm in."
Oh, that's fantastic.
And that's sort of how I got here.
Wow. So I'd love to go there for a second. How getting into that role and then COVID dropping on top of us. How was that?
We didn't get the grant the minute she wrote the grant. It took until June to get that grant. Meanwhile, COVID dropped and I'm still the executive director of North Carolina Families United, and my staff was and always will be very important to me. So from February to June, I didn't know if we were getting the grant or not. I wanted to make sure people were nurtured and, you know, cared for. And I obviously couldn't tell anyone that I was written into a grant because you don't know whether you're going to get it or not. Right. But for those months during COVID, it was very interesting running a family run org during those months. You know, I wanted to keep morale up. So, you know, I would have game, you know, we did trivia nights, mm-hmm. you know, we did, what was it? I had home office awards. So whose home office would look the best? And right. I was thinking, you know, this is only going to be a couple of weeks because right. COVID's going to end. You know, it'll be maybe March till maybe May, and then May came, maybe June. So I was waiting for it to end, totally. But, you know, we tried playing games at night and trying to keep staff morale up. Meanwhile, how do you serve individuals and families when you're all stuck at home? So we learned really well how to use Zoom and Mentimeter and all kinds of. We had Youth Move meetings on Zoom. We had a whole retreat, a 3-day retreat on Zoom for the youth. Can you imagine trying to keep them entertained on Zoom for 3 days? it was a very, very interesting time as an executive director of a state-run org during COVID. And my staff, they have and they always will be very important to me from North Carolina Families United. Well, on June 1st, I got the call. We got the grant.
Oh, wow.
Actually, I got the call and told Linda we got the grant. She didn't know. And then I had to, of course, say a very painful goodbye to my friends and colleagues at the state level. Mm-hmm. But then I became the project director with the National Federation of Families for NASDAQ. So that was so exciting. And although it was a sad part of my life to leave, you know, as the state executive director, it's been fabulous being the project director and working at the National Federation of Families. Because quite honestly, this has always been my dream since the first Federation of Families conference that I went to. And I said, I want to be Barbara. I'm not quite Barbara. And frankly, Linda is a much better Barbara than I am. But I love to be with Linda and stand side by side with her. It's been fabulous.
What's your favorite part of the job?
That.
Yeah, okay. Valid.
My favorite part of the job is.
Because you're clearly so excited for it and so happy in your role. And I love to see that.
My favorite part of the job is seeing this from a real macro level versus when you're at the state, it's the micro level and you're working with state individuals and it's very, you know, it's one state. We are now affecting, I have the ability to be influential in supporting families and youth for mental health and substance use across the country.
Wow.
So understanding that all our families, you know, they're experiencing mental health and substance use issues. And, you know, we're trying to erase the discrimination and prejudice and the fear of being found out that, you know, they have a diagnosis they may be using and all the complications. And here I am at the national level really trying to spread the word and provide webinars and educational information and office hours for family peer specialists who, by the way, have my heart. But, you know, the impact is greater. Mm-hmm. It's a national. That I guess that's what is the most exciting. I'm hitting 50 states and Guam and, you know, some territories. And that's exciting. And it's exciting to just know the kind of, you've been to this conference today. Look at the effect the National Federation of Families has on families across the country. And I'm part of that. That makes my heart sing. Mm-hmm. You know, we're sitting here, you know, in Linda's hotel room where we're having a conference where there's 700 people here, families and youth. And we're sitting, you know, where Obama found out he was going to be president of the United States. What was that, back in 2008? Is that right?
Something like that.
So he was sitting in this room as we look out in that canal and look at the Great Lakes.
So beautiful.
Isn't it amazing? I can't be happier being here and being part of the National Federation of Families family.
What's challenging about your role?
Well, there are challenges. Oh, certainly challenges. Always wondering if you're going to get renewed from SAMHSA or the grants. Challenges with staff. We have a great staff, but we're all virtual. You know, when I said I wanted to work for the National Federation of Families, my vision back in 1998 was going to Washington, D.C., having an office in D.C., heading up to the White House or sitting at Congress. Well, we do those kind of things, but all through my bedroom office.
Wow.
And it's located in North Carolina. So keeping, you know, working with staff remotely, and this is the only opportunity, this conference is the only opportunity we actually get to see each other.
Oh, this is it.
This is it. Some of my staff I had never met until today in person.
Wow.
So, well, until this week, I should say. Mm. But so working with staff remotely, really getting the feel, because sometimes there are things you can do with your staff and for others in person that you just can't do virtual. So I guess that's the challenge.
Okay. And so what is your role during the conference?
Let me see. My role during the conference, actually, I'm the exhibitor lady.
Okay.
So, you know, my face has been everywhere to say, if you're an exhibitor, go to the exhibit hall and talk to Gail. So I am in charge of making sure that all the exhibitors are well cared for. And giving out those raffle tickets,
yeah,
because we have a raffle every day, and you have to come to the exhibitors room to
get the raffle ticket. I'll be there tonight. I finally got my ticket in. Yep, I finally got my ticket in. I'll be there.
So that's one of my roles. The other role is I played an important part of the award ceremony. Mm-hmm. I did some of that. I mean, quite honestly, Linda has a great staff. I have a great staff. They did most of the work. I feel guilty saying I did anything half as great as what the staff here at the Federation of Families did for this conference. They worked. There were several people that worked very, very hard.
That's awesome. So in the field in general, because you've been working in this field for quite some time, what are the positive changes you've seen? And what are changes you'd like to see that we still haven't gotten to?
Well, we're a long way from where I'd like to be. However, I have seen the growth and the role and the importance now of family peer specialist. Mm. You know, when I first came on, now in North Carolina, we call family peer specialists family partners. Mm. And when I came to North Carolina, I wanted to get that workforce and lift it up. So, you know, my job, I thought, was lifting up the workforce so they can lift up the families and the youth, right, and the community that we serve. So, you know, I would support family peers. They would support the families. And we would role model that.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came to the state in North Carolina, we may have had 5. And no one called themselves the same consistent name. Some were family partners, some were family peer specialists, some were family advocates, some were parent partners. And I said, well, the first thing we have to do is start meeting, you know, at least once a month. So mm-hmm. I called everybody who identified with lived experience and was supporting other families to come together for a state meeting. Mm-hmm. And at first we had 5 or 6, and we had 5 or 6 regularly for a year or 2 years, and then it grew to 10 to 20. And, you know, and it grew, and now the workforce itself, I don't know where North Carolina stands on how many family peer specialists is, but it's moving and grooving. And so, and that's exactly what's happening throughout the country. Hmm. The family peer specialist role is finally being recognized as the workforce that supports families and youth.
Hmm.
And along with family peer specialists, people are understanding the difference between what an adult peer specialist is, what a youth peer specialist is, and what a family peer specialist mm-hmm. is, because that's a really confusing piece. And we need all 3 of them recognized and all 3 of them funded. Now, I know adult peer specialist or adult recovery specialist, they have got a little bit more of a head start as far as funding goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think family peer specialists have really got the competencies and the curriculums and the trainings. We've got that. Mm-hmm. We have a really solid hold on that. So that's always good. And youth peer, here they are. You know,
yeah,
adult peer and youth peer, are they the same? Well, sort of. Your lived experience to lived experience. But no one can speak to you. Someone who was a youth who experienced mental health and substance use issues when they were a youth can only speak that speak,
yeah,
in that way. And adult recovery individuals, they can speak to adult recovery. But a parent to a parent,
yeah,
for family peer specialists, that's where my heart is. All 3 are wonderful and extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I as a mother can only see someone else who's a mother who's walked in my shoes to help mm. me, because they understand what it's like to see a child, your child, or a piece of you. It doesn't have to be a biological child. It could,
right,
be your child of choice. But that person you love is suffering, is struggling, is experiencing difficulty. You know, a mother is only as happy as her saddest child. That's how I feel.
So I only have one kid, but my mom's got three of us, and that explains my mom to a T.
Oh, explains me.
It just perfectly.
Yeah. I can be happy as a clam, and because I know my kids are good. The phone rings, and one of them is experiencing some difficulty. My heart is ripped.
Right.
Yeah. And it goes, and that's why we do Lifespan now. Mm. I will tell you, it was a lot easier when you had a child who had attention deficit when she was 15 versus when you have an adult who is attention deficit at 21 because they're not living at home with you. And, you know, they're out on their own making choices. And luckily, my kids have always made pretty good choices. But I don't see them, so I don't have that control. It's very scary. And I need a family peer specialist to help me walk through that sometimes.
Wow. So yeah, so then what would you like to see? Where is this field going that you'd like to see?
Sustainable funding? More recognition. More recognition in the workforce, more understanding that an adult recovery specialist and a family peer specialist are two different things, although they have some overlapping and they're both necessary. They're very different and support different focuses, where the family focuses on the parent or the primary caregiver and not the individual. So I want more of that, more research. Mm-hmm. We need the research to say it works so we can expand the funding.
Yeah.
Funders want to see data, and we don't have the data we need. We really need data to say, yes, family peer mm-hmm. specialist, that family peer support works. That's it. More a real clear Medicaid definition nationally.
Yeah.
Information from CMS saying family peer specialists must be funded. You know, those would be great things. You know, we're getting there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we hear, you know, the first year when Biden spoke to the nation, the State of the Union, he talked about funding and more data for peer specialists.
Mm-hmm.
Now that he was talking in a very generalized words, but in so we take it as peer specialist, youth mm-hmm. peer, and family peer. But I would have loved to hear more of them saying, or him saying, yes, adult peer recovery, youth peer, and family peer specialist. I would love to hear those exact words because, like I said, sometimes family peer specialists get lost.
What's been your favorite experience? Can you give me a story, your favorite experience while working in this role?
Let's see. Oh, my goodness. Let me think. I know. NASTAC, the National Family Support Technical Assistance Center, which is the Center of Excellence for Families, we get technical assistance requests all the time.
Okay.
And one of my favorite ones, and they're here at this conference giving a presentation right now, I think, is the state of Pennsylvania decided they wanted to do a family peer support curriculum. They wanted to support that and start making that a recognized workforce in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a state individual and a family peer that's very widely recognized come together to start coordinating meetings with families and state advocacy organizations mm-hmm. and everybody. And they came to NASTAC for technical assistance. So myself and my colleague, my project manager, Lachelle Wade Friedman, and I met with them regularly for a couple of years, 2 years, very, very regularly, helping them set the agenda, kind of get them focused, kind of, you know, really getting the definition of what a family peer specialist, what you should do, how you should move forward. And we went to their we regularly attended their committee meetings and their collaborative meetings. And we made sure this Pennsylvania state family-run organization was included in all that, because mm-hmm. that's highly important. We've been able to wean our way off of them because they're soaring now, mm-hmm. and they're doing a really good job. And they're here actually talking, giving a presentation about how they did it.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty successful, don't you think?
For sure.
That's the technical assistance that NASDAQ does.
And coming full circle.
Yeah, exactly.
They got on their own.
Yes.
And now teaching others.
Yes, exactly.
That's cool.
So I think that's a really good one.
And last for you, as again, like you said, we look out this beautiful view. I don't know if you're going to get me out of here.
I know,
I just want to sit and watch the cars go by and the boats. What's in the future for you? What's
in the future?
Yeah,
for me?
Yeah.
Well, I hope that we have we get renewed. I would love for this grant to get renewed. So that's probably my biggest in the future, to be here for a little more. I'm only been here for 3 years. So I'm not thinking of leaving just yet. My future is just to stay on here and hopefully be the project director for the next round of the SAMHSA grant. I think that's it. You know, I'm living my dream job right now. Mm. I really am. I can't explain that to you. I am where I've always wanted to be.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
So, name and title.
Okay. My name is Lachelle Freeman, and I'm the project manager for both the National Family Technical... Let me start over. National Family Support Technical Assistance Center and the National Federation of Families project manager.
So, in essence, what do you do?
Okay, so we do a lot of educational programming. One of the big things that we do, we have 3 events every month. We do an hour and a half webinar. We do office hours for the family's peer support workforce. And we do an event called Family Connections, which is a great time for families and caretakers and providers as well to come together and discuss pertinent topics related to children and mental health and substance use.
Wow.
And then, I mean, there's a lot of other things, but we're doing our national conference right now, which is yearly. So there's a lot that we do for families.
So how long have you been in this role?
I have been in this role for about 2.5 years, but I've been in the field over 30 years.
Wow.
Yes.
So that's fantastic. That gives us plenty to talk about. So what do you think got you into this type of work, helping others? And because 30 years, there's got to be a passion there, because you don't
usually
don't stay around.
Absolutely. I honestly, the honest truth is I have a lot of mental health in my family. And when I was in high school, my track was engineering.
Oh.
I was going into engineering, and I took a psychology class and recognized that there may be some people in my family. This is very familiar to me for some reason. And I switched paths. And I don't know if it was like I'm going to develop coping skills to help my family or develop coping skills to save myself.
Right. Do you think part of it was a little, I might already have an AA in this, just from my lived experience?
At that time in high school, I knew nothing about lived experience. So I just knew the world.
Right?
I just knew the world that I lived in, and something that was going to make me want to improve it.
Wow. So where was hometown, or where is hometown?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And that's where my roots are. That's where my family is. And
Big family, small family?
I have a big family. My grandmother had 8 boys. So, yeah. And in my original family, we were a small family. It was just my mom, my dad. I have a brother and a sister. So, three. Mm-hmm. And then my family is, I have a son and a daughter.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. So how was high school?
High school was actually really fun. I had a blast in high school. And it was funny, though, because if you knew how to type really well, you got really great jobs in high school. So mm-hmm. you didn't really have to do the fast food. Not that I didn't do fast food, but sure. Yeah, I remember in high school working for an insurance company doing data entry.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
In high school.
In high school.
Not a lot of people have that in high school.
That's true. Very true. And my father was like, why are you working? You have your whole life to work, but...
Yeah. Oh, so it was your decision.
It was my decision.
Was it disposable money? Was it?
It was disposable money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And maybe. It was actually fun. I used to love to type. It used to like, it used to like calm me down. I loved data entry.
You know, my mom's the same way.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, with typing and shorthand and everything else, and she'll just.
Yeah.
She'll just fly, and yep. it's like a meditative.
It is. It's kind of like this ritualistic something. Who knows? Right. But I used to like it. I still like it.
Okay, so after high school?
After high school, I went to college. Went to Lincoln University of Pennsylvania. And I still was, like, into psychology. My major was going to be psychology, and that's what I did. And I had a great college experience, learned a lot, and yeah.
So after,
I went to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
Went to graduate school, and I did, this is where I learned about family systems, and I did, took family therapy track, and got a master's in counseling psychology.
Oh, man. I have a master's in systemic counseling,
so that's
close to my heart.
Yeah, I mean, once you realize that, you know, families are in systems, and you're part of that system, so whatever my theory was about healing my family, I'm like, I'm part of this system, right? But mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, I can still offer hope and stuff like that to other families.
That's amazing. And so where did you go once you got that degree?
Once I got that degree, I stayed in Pittsburgh, and I started off as a family preservation specialist doing in-home family preservation.
Oof.
Yes.
Oof.
Yes.
Been close to that too. Oof.
Yeah.
That's some hard work.
That is definitely some hard work, and if you think about it, you have to be on your toes, and you learn so many skills that the school did not teach you.
Isn't that the real world?
That is
the book world?
Yes, that's the real world. When you're going into people's homes and you don't know what to expect, and maybe they're having a crisis, maybe there's domestic violence, all types of things they didn't tell you about. I mean, they taught you about being safe and things like that, but mm-hmm. yeah, you definitely... You it's learn like a lot.
My professor didn't warn me about
this. No,
part.
No one said that, right?
Or the book says,
yeah.
This is supposed to happen next.
Yep.
But they're not able to do that yet.
Exactly. Or they didn't even train you that you would be going to people's homes, because that was almost a new thing when we started doing that, like meeting families where they were. So actually, my idea was I was going to be in an office.
Right.
But it was like driving all over town and, and going to people's homes and things like that.
I was supposed to be Frasier.
Right, exactly.
That, at least the training wise, yeah. was like, oh, you sit in a chair
yes.
across from someone, either in a chair or a couch,
yep.
and you talk through things,
yep.
and you set a goal, and yep. then next week they come back, and they've completed their goal.
Absolutely.
And we move on to the next thing, and everything's roses.
Healed in one episode.
Exactly. Exactly. Or at least enough to where they can heal thyself
yes.
from that hour.
Yes, and that is not the experience.
And then you end up in community mental health and go, oh. Wow.
Yes. So speaking of community mental health, so I was doing family preservation. And then the next thing I did was I became a therapist in the same system. And community mental health can be really draining for the simple fact that you have billable services that you have to complete, right? Mm-hmm. So I would maybe have 10 people scheduled in a day, 45-minute session, 15 minutes to write the note and read the plan for the next person who's walking into the door.
Well, and be honest, 15 minutes to figure out what you're going to write and your plan and all these smart things that you need to do to hopefully help these people.
And make sure they line up with the goal.
And then write it out. And then, yeah.
Yeah, that right there.
Yep.
So there have been many days that I drove home with in total silence, or many mornings that I prayed that every last one of them don't show. Like, at least let me have 3 no-shows.
Oh, yeah. Can I at least get canceled? Like,
that means I can have lunch.
Yes. They need to be there. They need the help. They need the services. But I just can't. I feel like I just can't hack it today, and I need to be able to breathe.
Yes, yes.
And so when the front desk calls and says, oh, by the way, so-and-so didn't show.
Right.
On the phone, you're like, oh, they need to be here. They, you know, darn it, we'll get them next time. And in your head, you're like, oh.
I have a break.
I can turn off all the lights and just chill for a second.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So how long did you go before you started to at least feel burnout from that?
You know what? It was interesting. It didn't take long because every case was physical or sexual abuse that occurred within the family or the what we call non-offending parents or the offending parents, which we probably would never use that language today, but that was back
right
like in the 90s. So yes, so I really did get burnt out pretty quick because it wasn't like just a case of normal just baseline mental health.
Right.
Everyone came in with, you know, pretty severe situations and trauma that they had experienced. But the one thing that really helped me was I had really great mentors and I had great supervision. So,
that is so important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to have someone who is checking in on you and also holding you accountable to the cases that you're responsible for.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that was a blessing within itself. Needless to say, I only did that for 2 years.
Okay, so trial by fire, 2 years.
Yeah, 2
Where do
years?
You go next?
Next I go to, I said, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to do clinical, I can't recall what it's called. It was like clinical coordination, but it was like the intake department.
Okay.
Where you took all the calls and you put them in the appropriate services.
So you get to get some of the information and then it's off your plate.
Yes.
And you move to the next.
Yes, you move to, you know, and I did that probably 3 years and kind of missed the interactions with the families.
Right.
So then I supervised within the same organization. I supervised what was called a parent teen conflict program. Okay. And we had teams that went into the homes for teenagers and their parents who were having conflict.
Wow.
So it wasn't still direct, but it was like oversight and providing supervision and, you know, giving that level of support to the workers who were going out into the field, knowing that I knew exactly what that stress was like and, you know, trying to give them skills and things to do to prepare them to be in a place to really serve families in a way that was meaningful.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was that a little more enriching and a little
that
bit?
That was because I got more of the clinical things, and I love to make sure that people know what they're doing. Like, as we said about the college, sometimes it doesn't really give you hands-on skills to do. Yeah. You're telling me I have to spend 20 hours with a family a week, and me as a supervisor and really an advocate for mental health. I don't want you watching TV with them. I don't just want you having snacks with them. Playing basketball is fine, but just as long as you know there's a plan, you know, you're doing that to engage and, you know, get connected. But at the end of the day, you still have some goals and this family requested or was ordered this service for a reason.
Right.
So.
Right. And like you're saying, like that real world, it's like how does that get missed in the education piece? Because so many people have the exact same story of like not everyone gets hired into a fancy couch to couch. You know, a lot of people you start out where you start out, and suddenly you're like, this is not it.
Yep.
Okay. So you say you did that for 3 years.
I did the clinical administration for 3 years. I can't even recall how long I did that parent-teen conflict program, but it was multiple years that we did that. Built a really great system in Allegheny County in Pittsburgh. Wow. So that was pretty cool.
And then where'd you go from there?
From there, I had took some time off because my father was sick. So I took time off to take care of my father. But then when I went back, I went into managing group homes.
One of these days I need to get on video because people who listen to this occasionally would have loved the face I just made. So, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Managing group homes.
Managing group homes. Yep. So that was very interesting and fulfilling. That's when I started learning about all of the rules and regulations that you had for what is appropriate living for the mm-hmm. places, what are the compliance regulations for the state and things like that. So it was was learning. You got to see teenagers transitioning from young adults. Really from teenagers to young adults and trying to prepare them to be successful in their own terms in the world.
Right.
So, yeah, that was great. It was really, that was good. And I did that probably up until I had my first child. All this time I was, I was young and didn't have a family of my own doing mm-hmm. all these things. And of course, having a child changed the dynamics of the work you do and how you do that, right? So.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have your first, and mm-hmm. then where do you go from there? I'm just
going
to take you straight through the timeline.
We're going straight through the timeline. So after I had my child, he was actually born very early. He was born at 25 weeks, 1 pound, 10 ounces. Yes. And of course, my plan was, I'm going to stay home with my child. And I don't think everybody, I have to admit, everybody's not the stay-at-home mom. I did it for 6 months, and then I was like asking all my friends, what did you do at work today? What was happening? Asking my husband, tell me about, this and that, and I'm trying to resolve problems. So I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to work. So I did go back to work. And still, I feel like I guess maybe I was kept moving away from direct practice mm-hmm. with the right, wrong, or indifferent. And I went to the University of Pittsburgh and started doing research for children who had mood disorders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So still working in the field.
Always
and
in
still
the field.
That passion for the field, but kind of that, I don't know if I want to go back to that
right.
really difficult
How can
work.
I impact the system on a higher level? And was how I kind of thought about it. Because one thing when I did the therapy, there are some people who are meant to be therapists. Mm. We had this one lady, and she... It was in her soul to be a therapist. Like, I would go to her and say, and this wasn't even my supervisor. I'm like, little girl wants to put her feet in the sandbox. We were playing in the sand, and she was put her feet in the sandbox. She was like, pull up a chair and spot her.
Right, right.
So this right. is, and she never wanted to become a supervisor. She never wanted to manage a program. She wanted to do the work with the children and the families. And that's what I love. Like, you have to find what is your space and what is your passion that you can, like I said, she didn't want to advance. This is my space right here.
Right.
And she loved it.
I feel I have the same. I've got her. This is almost, 15, 20 years ago. I've got mm-hmm. her face in my head of who
her.
I had at my facility.
Yeah.
And the same thing. Never a supervisor. But I would go and say, hey, what do I do? What's the problem? Support them in doing it. Are they hurting anybody?
Right. That part right there.
Right.
Just make sure she doesn't get hurt.
Right. Oh, they think that they see fairies in the park. Okay. What do they do with the fairies? Oh, they dance with them.
Yeah.
Okay. Where's the harm?
Right.
Let her have fun.
Yeah.
It's just funny. okay. So... research at Pittsburgh.
Yeah. University of Pittsburgh. And then my family, we moved to Maryland. And I went to the, I'm going blank on the name of it, but it still went into research. It was, I can't think of the name of it right now, but it was a research center in Baltimore. And we did things with, we worked with people on grants around people who are having first episodes of psychosis and how do we engage those families? How do we support those families? And then also doing a lot of like working on work groups and block grants. And this is when they started talking about those kind of like one-stop shops. Like how can we mm-hmm. have those, I forget what they call them, care homes or something like that, where you get your health, mental health, meeting all the dimensions of your needs, right? We also did a lot of surveys around how to really engage the families that you serve, mm-hmm. like from going into your office and assessing. I mean, do the pictures on the walls match how the people you serve, you know, mm-hmm. how do the people feel that the services are going, you know, and how can you, when you go to all these trainings, how do you not just go back to your office, put in your desk and check it off a list and keep moving, but are right. you putting it into practice, right?
I got my hours.
Yep. Got your hours.
I got my hours and it's signed. Somebody signed it.
It was great. You know, it was great and motivational, but then you get back home and real life is happening and yeah. you have a caseload of 1,000. What do you do with those skills? And who reminds you to utilize
them? Who supports you?
That part right there. That's why I believe that support and supervision is key to great mental health substance use services. Somebody has to give you some oversight and someone has to ensure that you're okay, because as helpers, we get into the field as helpers, right? So we want to help, 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 but we could lose sight of our own need.
For sure.
So, yeah. Oof. I know.
Oof. Preach.
Oof. Oh, my gosh. Yep.
Okay. And so where do you go from there?
From there, I go to North Carolina. This is home now. We're home. We were going right. towards home, right?
Perfect.
So when I get to North Carolina, I was like, oh, I just need a job. And I feel like I went back 50 years. 50 years, not because I was in that state, but in career-wise. So I went to an alternative school with children who had behavioral problems, and they'd been kicked out of public school, right. and they had to come to it wasn't residential, but it was like almost like maybe day treatment, possibly. Okay. And the children probably had 20 minutes of education in the whole day. Oof. And half the time, because of their behavioral concerns, they were doing everything to keep themselves from doing their academics. Right. So they were falling behind in the process of getting help. And I was like, oh my gosh, I did this when I got out of college. What am I doing here?
All right.
So I stayed there, I think like 8 months. And I then went to a managed care organization, okay. which was amazing, because what I learned in terms of billing and access to care and how they review your plans and stuff like that, that was great. At that point, they had just started merging entities to become managed care organizations. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, no one managed the request of service. No one had been told no, and that system was bankrupt. So, listen, here am I. I'm building. There's now an appeal department. So now we have a set of doctors that are reviewing those requests for medical necessity and either approving or denying services Whoa. To a population of people who had never been denied services.
Oh.
And guess who managed that program?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes.
So how did that feel going through that?
It was a great challenge to build something new. And my mind and thoughts were, people need to know what their rights are, and people need to know that this is really someone who is a system at some point that is trying to make sure that you get the right services, not just keep doing the same thing because that's what we're requesting, but really making sure that there's progress and things like that. But also to let people know that you have a right. Just because they said no, mm-hmm. you have an appeal process. You can say you don't agree with it, and you can, you know, stand up for your rights and say why you need this right. and everything, and go through a whole legal proceeding, due process. Everyone has that, and some people don't know that they have that right to do that. So we were able to talk with families. And of course, it's not as smooth as I'm saying it.
Oh,
you know, people, you know, when you disrupt a system, people are like, whoa, you know.
It's a shake up.
But yeah, but letting people know that they have rights and that there are people who can support you to go through that appeal process. So, you know, it was real rocky at first. And there were some families who would call. And anytime that person would call, they just send them directly to me. Because we know that, you know, this family is going to be upset about what this outcome was. And I could talk to them about their rights and what they can do in the next steps.
Well, and I think it's so important. We get either, I don't know if it's lulled or whatever it is, to this feeling of, or we just feel powerless, that, well, if someone higher up says no, well, then it's a no.
Yeah, or even like, I think about this, like if you ever apply for a credit card at a department store and they deny you, they send you a letter. Like, I'd never look at it and read, oh, there's an appeal process. Oh, right. Like, why did you deny me? Like, you know what I mean? Right, like, you know, whatever. But it's something that has to be done. When somebody denies you something, they have to offer you due process. Due process is you can appeal it. Right. And everybody doesn't know that. So it's interesting.
Well, and I just love getting that education out and that advocacy out that, you know, just that education of know your rights. And because sometimes the person who made the decision was having a really long day and they might have messed up and you might have a great case.
Yeah. Or your caseworker was used to writing in a certain way because they never really had to put any effort. And now you have medical professionals looking and say, well, what they wrote does not support what you're asking for. And we have overturned a lot of the appeal process, but there was a workforce that needed to really advocate for the families. And they had to learn what that was, you know? And then also, how do families know that they're making progress if they never step down in a service? You just keep giving them those high intensity services.
Right.
But the child has improved or the youth has improved. So now medically they don't fit that. So to me, that's progress to the family. Your family no longer needs this level of service. We're going to slowly step you down. Right. Hopefully not quickly step you down. Right. Because there's all different ends of the spectrum when how that happens. But, you know, sometimes families are relieved that, oh, wow, we are getting better.
Oh, for sure.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, what does it mean that you always have intensive service and you never progress to a lower level? Sounds bad, but lower level means you're functioning better.
Right.
So,
and you start to get families and folks that feel so reliant on that high intensity that it's going to take even longer to get them off of services.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So you build that.
So I was 5 years in there in the appeals department. And this great opportunity came, same organization, same managed care organization, to become the system of care project director.
Wow.
And that right there was so eye-opening. This is when I was really introduced to family peer support. I knew about peer support, but family peer support and really supporting and caring for the parents and caregivers of the children that they were, children, youth, adults that they were taking care of. And I say that along the things that I hadn't talked about is that I have a mom with a serious mental illness, a sister with a serious mental illness that I managed their care in a way. I talked to the psychiatrist. I talked to the therapist. I made sure med checks, this is what you said, go in there with a list of these are the questions you want to ask your doctor. You were concerned about this, do that. So all of this, not really realizing that I had this thing called lived experience and that there was family peer support in the world, right? And so I had a family peer support and she was the best. I was her supervisor, but she taught me so much. In terms of what family peer support really looks like and how you advocate and the importance of it. And vice versa, I was able to provide her with support when something was too close to home for her. And she was going into a meeting and she was in there ready to fight. Okay, that's not going to help you or the family. This is not your, you know. So just finding a balance and being able to build a relationship with family peer specialists to learn the work that they have and that, you know, all the book knowledge never introduced me to that or talked to me about that. So that was my introduction to family peer support.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And so where do you go from there?
So just about finished out that whole grant cycle, which is 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then I got a call to join the National Federation of Families.
There we are.
What is that?
The first question anyone has when they hear. Yes.
Yes. So, and not only that, to join them, but they had just got that grant to do the first Family Support Technical Assistance Center. Okay. So, like I said, I'm living and breathing mental health in my own personal life with my mother and my sister. And then probably about 5 years ago, my son was diagnosed with a serious mental illness.
Because it's usually family.
Yeah.
It's genetic. It falls through. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. And so I really, really became a family peer with lived experience. Managing him through school systems and mental health systems and trying to help him, you know, kind of find his way in this world or at least put people in his path. Mm-hmm. Because he's still finding his way. You know, he's 22. So he's still finding his way in a general sense. But when you add on mental health, he had a severe car accident. Mm. I believe he has some level of brain trauma. But to me, as a mom, I don't care if it's brain trauma, mental health, what it is, how do we get you to a place and a space where you feel comfortable living right. successfully in life?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. As a parent, yeah, it's I just want my kid happy.
Yeah,
and successful
like
in
yeah.
whatever way that looks.
Right. How can you find your people? How can you find your crowd?
Oh, my gosh. So 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you get hired into the role you're in now?
Yes. Okay. So when I came to, that's the role that I got. Almost was 2.5 years that I've been with the Federation of Families. So, okay. Yeah.
And so your day-to-day, what's it look like?
My day-to-day is a lot of putting work plans together to ensure that we have successful services, whether it's our webinar. We have a team that I'm responsible for the webinars. So I'm constantly looking for subject matter experts and family members along the same lines to be able to provide really great insight on our webinars. And that's a lot of planning to do within itself. But that meeting with the team to talk about whether it's the latest policies that we are endorsing, that we believe in. What are we doing with the affiliates, which are family-run organizations nationally, and mm-hmm. how do we support them, you know? Taking in TA requests. You know, they're popping. It could be, you know, we could have a month that we have 10, we could have a month that we have 2. Mm-hmm. But we're open to that. We always want to advocate what we are doing, how we are helping families and things like that. So I don't even know. It's all those other duties as...
Yeah, exactly. The very end of the job description.
Yes.
Where
yes,
it's basically
yes.
saying whatever else we come up with.
Whatever it takes to get the mission accomplished.
What's the favorite part of your job right now?
I don't know. I'm thinking this conference is starting to be my favorite because this conference this week was amazing. It was energizing. And it made everything that we do at the Federation worth it. Mm-hmm. When you see light bulbs come on, people motivated, the ahas, and just a sense of how can we move this social justice movement, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that this conference is coming to it, but the conference is not my day-to-day, but it is almost like 6 months
sure.
of the year that, you know, the planning is happening. But I love our Family Connections programming, and Family Connections really is with families coming to listen to different topics, and we, after the subject matter expert and the family expert talk, we open up the mics. Turn on your cameras, mm-hmm. open your mics, let's have conversations about this. And when people are able to ask questions and to relate and to realize that they're not the only one who is experiencing this with their children as a parent and things like that. So I love our family connection.
That's awesome. What's challenging about your job?
So it is remote. So
I heard that.
It's remote. So we're all over.
I mean, most of my job is remote as well, yeah. But at least I see my coworkers once a month or something.
Might see each other once or twice a year. Yeah. Well, we see each other almost daily or at least three times a week via Zoom. A whole different thing. But yeah, you could miss those water cooler conversations or can't just go down the hall and say, hey, but you can, you can call them, you could text them, you could, get on. Let's hop on the Zoom real quick, you know? So I would say that's probably the most challenging thing. The other challenging thing is when families can't get the services that they need, whether it's a wait list, it would be great if we had family peer support to hold people and help them try other things or get connected with natural supports while they're waiting for, services to start, but not every state funds it.
Right.
It's a funding issue. So, it's probably very discouraging when there's services out there that can help families, but families can't really access them because mm-hmm. of whether it's access to care or whether it's insurance or whatever that thing is. So, yeah.
Okay. So 30 years in the field.
Mm-hmm.
Over that time, what's a positive change that you've seen, and what's something that you see that still needs significant work on?
Oh, wow, that's a hard one. Positive, and I want to say it happened prior to COVID, but people just being more open about mental health. Mm. It used to be so taboo, but it still is taboo, if that makes sense, right? Because you still see people make comments about people who are on medication, or they think twice about possibly hiring them, things like that. So there's still a lot of discrimination around that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that people also are more open to, even I would have to say my children's generation, 19 and 22, where they're really open. They're talking about their diagnosis, what medication they're on. I mean, they're really free spirits discussing everything. So there is a level of openness to talk about mental health, not so much substance use, mm-hmm. but there is a openness of people saying, I'm seeking services, or I'm trying this medication, or I'm anxious about something, much more than I saw before. I think we still have silos in our systems. Not everybody has the same access. Mm-hmm. We talked about that this morning in the plenary session, whether between private insurance and Medicaid, the services are not the same. But I also am very hopeful because we have people who are going to advocate to the day that they, leave this earth, right? And as long as we have people making decisions where you have your level of power, I feel like that there can be success in small mm-hmm. pockets. And success doesn't always happen in huge jumps and chunks of time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you build foundation. If you're building that foundation, I feel like this is the optimistic in me.
Right.
Your things will change over time, And making sure that you're taking care of yourself and making sure that, you're actively in the politics of things, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if you have voice and really power to make decisions in families. This whole new world, like I said, the last 2.5 years, learning about family peer support and families learning that they have the ability to advocate for what they and their children need is very encouraging. So, I think those are the things that there's some good movement and mental health and substance use, and we have miles to go.
Okay. I think last to wrap up, do you got a good or funny work story you can give me?
Good or funny work story, That's a hard one. Let me think about this. Like in relation to anything?
Anything. I just like a good story. I like to wrap up with a good story.
Let me think about this. Ah, you got me on that one. Oh. I can't think of a good story.
Oh, that's fine.
There's multiple stories, but
like that one, I don't want to out my friend for doing that. That one, I don't want to get fired for.
Go back a thousand. Yep. Go back. Okay. Let me go back a thousand years in history and think of something funny. No, I can't. I can't think of. Yeah, but there's a lot of things that happen.
I won't push.
Thank you. I'm a party pooper here.
You know, I had to try.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me and being on the podcast.
My pleasure.
And there you go. Two great interviews with two wonderful professionals. Thank you so much to Gail and Lachelle for sitting down with me and talking about your work. Again, my name is Joe Saladino. I'm your host at the Dads Move Podcast. Hope you enjoyed and see you next time.